Here, it is wonderful. I feel my soul is at peace, it has peace. But pay attention. The passions have not left here. The passions have not gone. You must take care to root out the passions precisely at the moment when the causes have been given. In St. Cassian the Roman, when we come to the passion of anger, we'll see this beautiful example. You flee to the desert because you say you get angry with other people. I'll be all by myself, you think, so that I won't get angry. And you go to cut wood for your fire, and there the log slips out of your hands, and you get angry, and yet you had no people to get angry at. Wretched soul, you carry the passion with you wherever you go, whether you have the occasion for it to show itself or you don't. I beg you to make a note of this. This is why the ascetics stayed in the desert their whole life. To uproot, not the sins. Sin is uprooted very easily. How is it uprooted? Go and make your confession. And at once their sins were wiped away. All those who came today and confessed, their sins were wiped away. But I ask you, did the passions leave? Because they did not leave. That is why they will come back again for confession. They will come back. This is a point, I repeat, that we must pay particular attention to. And now we come to see how the passions make their nest within us. You will have heard, and if not, you'll be surprised to hear, that the passions are represented by the demons, that a person who has passions has many demons within him. And the fathers speak of the passion, of the demon of fornication, the demon of sorrow. Indeed, St. Cassian the Roman says that the demon of sorrow is the most terrible of all. What is your name? The demoniac? The Gergesene? What did he answer? My name is Legion, for there are many demons. So here it is confessed that this demoniac had surely become so from many passions. And he already had passions too, and certainly these came from the demons. When Christ wanted to make the man well, did he heal the passions or did he drive out the demons? He drove out the demons, and the man became well. But notice something here, for there is a deception in this. We might think that, in that case, it is the demons who are to blame. When he made that paralytic well, the man who had been paralyzed for 38 years, what did he say to him? Take care, sin no more, so that nothing worse happened to you. And here, right here, is the key to our whole subject. The passion begins from the person himself. And once the passion is established within the person, the devil comes and makes his nest upon it, and he takes dominion over the person, sometimes over the soul, if the passion is of the soul, such as the love of money, and at other times over the body, if the passion is bodily, such as, for example, drunkenness. Let me give you a small example. As I'm walking along, I fall down and hurt myself, and I make a wound on my hand. I made that wound through my own carelessness. I fell and got hurt. Now, germs come upon the wound, and the germs make it so the wound won't close, and it is in danger of turning into gangrene. The doctor I call, what will he do? He'll close the wound, but he'll also do this. He'll give antibiotic injections, penicillin, and so on, to destroy the germs. And by destroying the germs, the wound is healed. So then, just as the germs settle upon the wound, so the devil settles upon the passions. So it is not that the devil created the passions, in which case, he would be the one responsible. I created the passions, and then the devil came to sit upon those passions. Let me put it another way. By any passion whatsoever, I open the door to the devil, and I say to him, come in, and the devil, so to speak, enthrones himself and takes possession, as I told you. A bodily passion can be brought on without sin. We see this in that good woman, the bent-over woman, who evidently went every Sabbath to the synagogue to hear the word of God, and the Lord reveals to us that the devil had bound her for 18 whole years. It was a passion, a bodily one, an illness, that is, illness is a passion, a bodily passion. But with such passions as illnesses, often the person is not responsible, though at other times he is. So we see that the devil sometimes comes against our will, but he will create a passion that is not sinful. And at other times, we ourselves create the passion, and that it is sinful. And our existence becomes, I did not say our soul, I said, our existence, because it nests in the body too. Our existence becomes a dwelling place of the demons. But when Christ cast the demons out of us, we are in danger of acquiring the demons all over again. Certainly, and when? When there is something we call negligence of the soul. It is this case, the Lord says, that when the demon leaves the person, a passion has gone out. You went to church, God helped you, the passion left, that is, the devil left, he was driven away, and this demon, he says, wanders through waterless places. The soul remains in its negligence, in its sloth, and he says, it neglects to adorn the soul with virtues, and the demon comes back. It sees, he says, the soul clean and swept, swept and tidied. And it says, ah, how lovely it is here, and to think I had left my old house. It goes and takes seven other demons, more wicked than itself. Seven means a multitude. Seven means a multitude, and it returns. And then, the Lord says, the last state of that person is worse than the first. So you see that the devil takes up residence within a person. Let us keep watch over the passions, so that we do not become demon-possessed. The demon-possessed person is not, first and foremost, the one we see thrashing on the ground, or speaking aloud, the hidden things of people's hearts. You know, this terrible thing. In a gathering of people, a demon-possessed man reveals their secret sins. He says, you who did that thing there, you who did that other thing. And people are left dumbfounded when their sins are exposed. Not that, but this is now something terrible. It is the very extreme of demonic possession. Yet when we let the passions be, the devil keeps coming to nest within our soul, so that we cannot live in virtue, because the devil will always keep us bound. We will see this on the subject of gluttony, for example. When the hour comes for us to go and say our prayers, we grow drowsy, because we ate too much and drank too much, and now we are drowsy. We say, it won't happen again, and a little while later, it happens again. If we examine ourselves closely, I fear that all of us here, more or less, have left doors open to the demons, and the devil holds us bound, some of us in one way, some in another. So here, how exactly are we to fight within the struggle against the passions? How can we carry on our struggle effectively? Of course, there are very many ways. You will see, if you read the ascetic fathers, the neptic fathers, that each one proposes ways he himself tried in order to conquer his own passions. One of them, when he feels temptations of the flesh, strips off his clothes and goes and throws himself into a patch of nettles and rolls around in them, as I think St. Martin did, if I remember rightly, rolling in the nettles to conquer the passion of the flesh. Or another ascetic who killed a mosquito and said, why should I kill a mosquito? Be careful here. Don't misunderstand the matter because you'll say to me, but we ourselves use repellent to kill the mosquitoes. Well, what can I say beyond that? I'll tell you another incident and you'll understand more. It is a creature of God. If the mosquito turns against me, it is because I have sinned. And with anger, this ascetic had killed the mosquito. It was one of those mosquitoes, the big ones, the African ones. This happened in Africa, in Nubia. Why did I kill the mosquito? And with anger, at that, I will punish myself. There was a lake nearby where the mosquitoes gathered. He strips off his clothes and stays a whole night for the mosquitoes to devour him, because he had grown angry in killing the mosquito. You see that there are very many ways. To take another turn, St. Luke, in Boeotia, where there is that marvelous Byzantine monastery that is now under the archaeological service and so on. I don't know if you have been. I have not. It is considered a monument, one of the few we have in Greece from a Byzantine standpoint, in terms of its architecture, in terms of its art. The mosaics and everything else are masterpieces. St. Luke, who lived somewhere around the 10th century, was a simple man, an ascetic. And every year on Palm Sunday, he had the custom of taking a heavy, large cross and climbing to the top of the mountain. And there he would pray. One year, as he set out, a viper bit his toe. He was barefoot, and it bit his toe, and its fang, its jaw, stayed lodged there on the toe of his foot. He realized that the devil was hindering him from going up the mountain as he did every year. He bends down, takes hold of the snake, pulls it off his foot, and says, go your way, and I'll go mine. God made you, God made me, God made you, and God made me. So off you go, in peace. He did not kill it, just as the Apostle Paul. When the viper bit him and hung, it says, from his finger, from his hand it hung. The viper, when they had gone to gather brushwood on Malite, after the shipwreck they had suffered, and he went to throw the brushwood on the fire. This viper, warmed by the fire that was there, sprang out and bit his finger. He threw it into the fire. He threw it into the fire and suffered no harm. You will ask me why the Apostle Paul threw the viper into the fire, while St. Luke said to the viper, "Go your way now, off you go in peace." There are various ways in which we see the things in nature, in creation, and there are countless thousands of instances. And the struggle is varied, varied, varied. But in the course of the subjects we will be analyzing, I will also point out marks and elements of the struggle. For example, St. John Climacus says, "I think, when you have temptations of the flesh, do not read homilies of the fathers that deal with these subjects. Read about almsgiving. Read whatever you like, read anything, but do not read homilies on this. It would seem very natural. One would say that since I have a temptation of the flesh, I should read a discourse, a homily of a father that deals with this subject. No, read anything else, but that. It seems strange. All of this comes out of experience. The saints have their spiritual father, I said that as an example. But tonight, in your love, we will speak only of the basic methods. Not that there are three, there are a multitude, but at least three are somehow basic. Like this, the first is, as St. Isaac the Syrian says, by the remembrance of the virtues, one steals the passions away, rather than resisting them head on. It is preferable to steal them away, to outwit them, by remembering the virtues, to resist them. A small example. You are walking down the street and you see something filthy. At once you turn to yourself and say, "What is the conversation with yourself? Now, what were we saying? What were we talking about a moment ago? Ah, so I have to go to church tomorrow. And how lovely it will be there. There will be a beautiful liturgy full of compunction. We will all receive Holy Communion. Ah, we'll have a truly wonderful time. What did you do here? You did not wage your struggle against the passion by saying, 'Get away from here. I don't want to see you. Get out of here.' You don't do that. Instead, you steal the passion away by shifting your interest onto something else, onto the remembrance of good things. This method is very important. It does not mean, of course, that at some point we will never fight the passion itself head on. But St. Isaac says it is better. It is better to steal the passion away by the remembrance of good things. As you know, habit is the nurse of a passion. The passion is fed by habit. That is, through repetition. Through repetition and habit, this is why St. Isaac says again, fear your habits more than your enemies, more even than the enemies. I spoke about this to the children in class 303 this morning, and I gave them an example, since it came to mind, though it is a bit disgusting. You'll forgive me for telling it to you as well, since I remembered it. I mentioned habits. We have habits that may not in themselves be sin, but in any case, they are not good habits. They are the disgusting habits. My nose itches. And as you all see me now, I begin to scratch at it a little there. The next time, next Monday, my nose itches again. And this time, precisely because I did it once before, I scratch a bit more. After a while, I have begun to get used to scratching my nose in front of other people. And while I'm speaking to you now, I keep scratching my nose, and it costs me nothing. I don't even think that it might disgust you. Because I've grown used to it. Because I've grown used to it. Do you know how many such bad habits we have in our life? In our life, that make our presence a nuisance to others. Either we stand too close to someone as we talk, or we lean on them, or we say, "Well, what does it matter if I eat garlic too? Never mind." And then the person gets on the bus. And the poor soul next to him could retch when the man comes out reeking of garlic first thing in the morning. He ate it the night before. But his breath smells dreadful in the morning, and so on, and so on, and so on. A whole multitude of them. Or that other man on the train who takes off his socks and shoes and starts scraping at his toes, right there on the train. Won't the person beside him be disgusted? This is a real thing, my dear ones. My sister saw it on the train while she was traveling. It was a terrible sight. And yet that man, because he used to do it at home in front of others, grew used to it, and it no longer costs him any effort to do it in front of others. See what such things there are. It is habit. That is why St. Isaac says, "Forgive me for how graphic the examples are. They are disgusting. But never mind," he says. This is why, he says, fear habits more than your enemies. And he goes on to say, habit. And now I come to the main point. Habit. If it makes a request once, and that request of its is not granted, if it asks for something once, and is blocked. It asked, that is, and did not get what it asked for. Another time you will find it grown weak. The next time this habit returns, it will have weakened a little. But if you do its will once, if you satisfy its will one more time, then the second time, you will find it stronger against you. You will find it stronger against you the second time. That is, this thing is now tormenting me. Let me just satisfy this curiosity of mine. For instance, you see two neighbor women talking outside, and you're seized with curiosity to go and see what they're saying. If you conquer the temptation and do not go out, then when they begin talking outside a second time, tomorrow or the day after, your habit of wanting to go out will be weaker. If, on the contrary, you don't hold yourself back and you say, "But I can't, I'll burst." If I don't go out and you go out to satisfy your curiosity, you have strengthened the habit, and the next time it will be stronger against you. Let us know this too. And one last thing, it is the method of the antlion, a non-existent creature that has the head of an ant, and then, from the middle back, is a lion. There is no such animal in nature. It is made up imaginary. The fathers of our church devised it in order to present the method, the one of the same name that I mentioned to you, the method of the ant lion. What is this method? Sin usually comes and appears disguised, beautiful and small. And it tells you it is no great thing to commit this or that. It is a small matter. But once the sin has been committed, then it turns out to be very great. You yourself see it as very great once you have committed it, but there is something more. At first, sin seems very slight and easy to do. You are a treasurer somewhere, and a temptation comes in. Come now, do this for me. Put your hand in there, take 100 notes. The world won't end. A little here, a little there. In the end, if you cover it up, it won't show. The temptation is small, or rather, it is not that the temptation is small, but the act seems the sort of thing where it is perhaps not hard to say no. But once the act has grown into a giant because you have repeated it again and again, then how will it stand before you? Like a lion, an ant you can kill. You defeat it without question. But the lion, can you defeat it? So then, at the very start, when the passion and the sin first rise up in front of you, you must say, "I will kill this sin, I will trample it underfoot." But if you let it grow from an ant into a lion, then honestly, you are ruined. You will no longer be able to overcome the passion. Listen, my beloved, to how St. Nilus the ascetic says this. For the assaults of the passions begin from trivial imaginings, from something that is nothing at all, but in the end, you see, they swell into a great mass, and this is why the one who struggles must keep up the fight. He must wrestle against the passions. He must wrestle against the passions. At the very moment they come as ants. When the passions come to us like ants, offering their triviality as bait, they bring with them, like bait, like a lure, this triviality, that it is nothing, that it is no great matter. For if they reach the strength of the lion, if they grow to the power of the lion, they become almost impossible to fight off. They can no longer be driven away. This is why there is a passage, a verse from the Psalms, which in itself carries one meaning. Yet the fathers, the interpreters, have also given it an allegorical sense. In the mornings I put to death all the sinners of the land. Listen to this verse. In the mornings I put to death all the sinners of the land. And now one of the Neptic fathers of the church asks, who are all the sinners of the land? They are the sinful legismoi, the intrusive thoughts. And what does it mean that he killed them in the morning? It means that you must kill these evil thoughts at their very beginning. Just as the day begins in the morning, so you must overcome them at their start. Because if you let them remain inside you, they will surely overpower you. As you saw, my dear friends, even today we did not enter the first subject on gluttony. For what I had in mind was exactly what I told you. It was only a small remainder. We could have moved into the subject of gluttony today, since I have it ready. But I saw that this small remainder turned out to be rather large. It took up the whole of our time. Forgive me for that, but perhaps it is useful for this analysis to be made. So let us pray that we may begin to conquer, or rather to struggle, because our struggle against the passions is fierce. It is fierce, and many times we have let this seed of evil fall into our heart, and it has taken root and sprouted, and grown into a great tree that we cannot easily uproot. Without ascesis, without ascetic discipline, we can do nothing, sins and the passions do not depart as if by magic. We must learn to struggle, to say a hard no to ourselves in many things. Sometimes, we must avoid even lawful things, because next to what is lawful, certain passions are often attached. Or if, for example, I know that someone has a leaning toward wine, while it is no sin for him to drink a small glass of wine at his table, it is no sin. Yet not every day if possible, not every day. And besides, on Wednesday and Friday, when we eat no oil, we also take no wine. So a small glass would not be a sin. But if I knew that this man was prone to drunkenness, I would tell him not to drink even that little glass. What does this show us here? The refusal even of a lawful thing for the sake of fighting a passion. The passions always hold out a bait, that life will become very beautiful if we keep the passions in our life. But while they invite us to enjoy life by letting the passions in, tomorrow it will toll for us like a funeral bell. The talk we have just heard is the first in this year's cycle, and it is the introduction to the subjects concerning the deadly sins and the passions. The second talk follows, once again on the theme of the passions, on the eight logismoi of wickedness, the intrusive thoughts, that they are something which encompasses all the other passions, and that what in turn encompasses these eight logismoi of wickedness or deadly sins are these. These are the love of pleasure, the love of money, and the love of glory. The passions in general certainly assail man. St. John of Damascus says, whether these eight thoughts trouble us or do not trouble us is not up to us. But whether we dwell on them or not, whether we stir up the passions or not, that is up to us. That is to say, whether the eight logismoi, and consequently the passions, trouble us or not, is a matter that does not depend on us. But whether these logismoi, these passions, remain or do not remain, whether they move within us or do not move, that depends on us. This is extremely important, and we must be sure to note it, what depends on us and what does not. For there are many who reckon as sin that which does not depend on them, such as the provocation. Remember, we were saying last time that these three comprehensive passions are nothing other than the three temptations of the Lord, to satisfy his hunger by making bread out of the stones. Remember, to consent to throw himself down from the pinnacle of the temple, and to worship the devil, who told him he would give him all the treasures of the earth. But the provocation, the presence of the devil before the Lord, does not mean that the Lord sinned. This distinction must be kept between the provocation and sin. Yet, in order to have a clearer picture of things, we must certainly look at the process of sin, so that we may know what is sin, what is not sin, and how a passion forms. It is not the matter of a single day, but the matter of a certain length of time. This is why it is necessary, as I stress to you, to look at the process of sin. Let me follow St. John of Damascus. The first stage is the provocation. St. John says, the provocation is simply the suggestion put forward by the enemy. You see, the enemy comes and tells you, do this, a suggestion. He sets you to do it. He reminds you to do it. He pesters you to do it. He says, do this or that, do this, do that, just as the devil did with our Lord and God. This, as has already been said, does not depend on us. And so, if someone receives the assault of sin, as for example, when a lovely aroma of food reaches you on a fasting day, that is an assault. And now this whole assault is telling you to go and eat some of that food you just smelled, that it reached your nostrils and made your mouth water, that the gastric juices, as we said, began to be set in motion. This is not a sin. When you say, this far and no further, nothing else, nothing, we do not accept it. We will not eat. So the provocation is not a sin, I repeat. There are many who torment themselves by treating the provocation of sin as if it were sin. They consider themselves so excessively sinful that whatever they do, whatever they make, whatever they think, however they walk, they always regard it as sin. Do you not think that the life of such a Christian would be a torment? At least that is how I see it. And one cannot feel the joy of the spiritual life. He thinks that everywhere and always he is sinning. Whatever he takes up, whatever he says, whatever he does, everywhere and always he is sinning. Your neighbor tells you, let us say, a piece of gossip. You do not want it. You say, I have sinned. How many times do you come and tell something your neighbor told you when you did not want it? You walked away, you did not want to hear it, and yet you begin to recount it as though it were a sin. That is a provocation. You did not sin. The second stage after the provocation is coupling. This word coupling is not very clear to us, but I will read what St. John says, and there another word has been used that is fairly understandable to us. Then comes the acceptance of the thought put forward by the enemy, that is, dwelling on it and taking pleasure in conversing with it, coming out of our own free will. So what is this? It is acceptance. Acceptance means that the attack came, and right away, I began to discuss the matter. As he puts it so tellingly here, dwelling on it, you keep turning it over. Pleasurable conversation, and conversation means keeping company with it, that is, I begin to discuss it, but with pleasure, gladly, out of our own free will. This is a second stage, and it is here that sin begins. From this point, sin begins. Let me give you a little example. Perhaps it will not be quite fitting for the world, you know. But it fits very well for illustrating the point. You probably know, you have probably seen, that there is a ball game called volleyball. There is the net, and two teams play on either side. When the ball comes into a player's hands, he has to send it off at once, to pass it. If he holds onto the ball, they will call him for holding it too long. He simply held it, and then threw it. In volleyball, that counts as a mistake, a fault. The side loses the point whose player held the ball. The moment the ball came to you, you should have passed it straight on and let it go. The same thing happens with the assault, the first suggestion of a tempting thought. When the assault comes and you give it one and send it off, you have not sinned. But when you held it a little, that assault, and you began to work it over and turn it this way and that, saying this and that, the how and the why, from that moment you begin to sin. So now you understand from when sin begins. After acceptance comes consent. That is, the decision. St. John says it is the soul's ascent toward the logismos, the intrusive thought. This is what is called consent. You give your consent. You decide that it is so and that you would like to do it. Clearly, the decision here is something very hard. Sin begins to take on flesh and bone. For, let me give you a little example. You say, you keep saying that the neighbor woman wronged me. I am going to go and kill her. Listen, I am going to go and kill her. At that moment, someone comes and says to you, take a knife, for the love of God. You will say, listen, he hands you the knife. Did you not say you would kill her? He gives you the knife. For the love of God, you will say, so am I to go and kill the neighbor? Did you not say it? So it means you spoke a word, but you had not made the decision. But if you actually take the knife and now you go to kill the neighbor, it means you have made the decision. What is this? That is, sin begins to become flesh, to take on flesh and bone. But when a sin is first committed, it naturally meets the resistance of our conscience, and the resistance of other things as well, such as the resistance of fear, that is, that they might see what I am about to do, and also the resistance of punishment, or of being condemned by others. But above all, the resistance of the conscience, when the conscience comes and says that what you are doing is a sin. And you can see, the conscience begins to react because the decision has been taken, and our decision, in its turn, also begins to react. And then, between two reacting forces, the decision and the conscience, a struggle sets in. Who has not known such a struggle? Shall I do it? Shall I not do it? But I must do it. But it is a sin. But no, I will do it. And often this struggle can last from a little while to a whole night when we cannot sleep, sometimes a whole day, sometimes a week or a month. And for great matters, this struggle can sometimes last a very long time. What will win? It is uncertain. Will the decision to sin win? Or will our conscience win? It is uncertain. You realize that if I have let sin reach the point of struggle, in the end I cannot know whether I will be saved, because I may give in. I must tell you that many times we let sin reach the point of struggle. We love to dwell on sin, indeed, often on sins of the flesh. Notice what I said, often sins of the flesh. We hand over our heart, we hand over our mind to the sins of the flesh. And when we see that things are going very badly and we're about to fall very low, then a struggle begins. No, I don't want this to happen. I don't want it. But you've already gone far over the edge. How can you say you don't want it And not seldom, my dear ones, we fall. We fall because in the end the scales tipped, the resolve we had at the start, and the struggle, the conscience that had been at work, came to no happy end. We didn't come through it well. We fell. We buckled. Do you know how many young women have been lost? And I speak of young women because I have an audience of ladies. How many young women have fallen? They fell into fornication, many of them, because they began from nothing at all, from nothing, from a bit of flirting, from a single meeting, from a face we keep looking at and gazing at, and they began, like moths, to circle around the lamp, around the fire, round and round and round and round. Eh, it isn't burning me. It isn't burning me. I'll go a little further. The thing doesn't burn. Nothing is happening to me. And then at some moment, they realize that they have fallen. Irreparably, they had fallen, because they had reached the point where they would fight and not let themselves fall. But alas, the conscience did not win. If in the end the decision wins, we go on to a fifth stage, which is the acting out, the carrying into deed of the assent to the impassioned thought. For it is the completion of sin. The sin is accomplished. It is done. It is finished. Here we ought to stop, since the sin has been carried out. But the matter does not stop here. There are still two more stages. Usually there has been a relapse. Usually with sin the question arises again, that it be repeated. As if someone committed a sin once and did not do it again. But usually it is repeated. And then this sin that we committed comes back to tell us, do it again. And of course, it stirs within us. And again, the sin will follow the very same process. Attack, acceptance, assent. Only this time, it certainly runs through this course without the difficulty of the first time. Because, after the attack, the acceptance will perhaps come more quickly. The assent, too, will be quicker, and the struggle weaker, so that the sin is repeated at once. And if it happens a third time, and a fifth, and a tenth, the more often it happens, the more this whole process begins to fade. We no longer have acceptance, nor assent, nor struggle, nor anything at all. We would go straight from the provocation to the act. The moment a person feels the provocation of sin, that first suggestion, the act follows, at once. A person who has repeated the same sin 5, 10, 50 times comes to realize something. He realizes that this act has become like a second nature to him, a habit. So what, then, is a passion? A passion is formed by a combination. The acceptance of the thought suggested by the enemy turned into a habit, together with pleasure, constant dwelling on it, and imagination. That is, you acquire the habit of repetition, and you carry the thing that preoccupies you constantly in your imagination, endlessly turning it over. It keeps circulating in your mind, senselessly. This thing the passion wants to strike at. Take, for example, the passion of drunkenness. He sees nothing else before him except where and when he will go to drink wine. He has nothing else on his mind. This is all he thinks about, without ceasing. The problems of his household do not concern him, nor do his children, only where he will go tonight to drink wine. And the habit drags him along, exactly as a bear is dragged by that ring which pulls it, or by its handler, in the same way a person constantly wants to do the thing he craves. So we have arrived at the passion. The passion, therefore, is nothing but the habit formed by committing the sin many times over. Have we stopped here? If only evil could ever stop. If only it could. We have not stopped. There is something further still. If at some point a person wakes up, if he is able to wake up, from the passion that drags him, he longs at last to be freed. He has grown weary. And then he realizes that he is a captive. The mouse goes into the trap because it wanted to eat the cheese, but then it wants to get out of the trap. Indeed, at first it had said what a fine place this is, to go inside and eat cheese there. And how lucky it was to find a spot with cheese inside. That is how it sees things. Once it has eaten the cheese, then it feels that it must leave. At the same time, it feels that it is a captive. It cannot leave. The very same thing happens with a person who finds himself in the grip of the passion. He wants to leave, but he can no longer do so. The case that is not yet captivity is the case where a person still loves his passion. Captivity is when a person no longer loves his passion, yet is unable to free himself. What misery there is, my dear ones, in such cases, says St. John of Damascus. Captivity is the forced and unwilling carrying away of the heart, held under tyranny by an old predisposition, and by long-standing habit. This is the process that sin follows until it reaches the passion and captivity. And now the question arises, could we not have stopped? It is self-evident that we ought to stop at the provocation, that very first suggestion. When you hear people say that the way to attain virtue is hard, it is because they have not learned to stop at the provocation. By now it has reached the passion. When you are given the advice not to smoke or not to drink wine after you have already become a drunkard or an addict or a blasphemer or an immoral person, how are you to turn back then? Is that easy? It looks like a mountain to you. But when you have not yet started down the road of the sin, when you have never smoked and someone tells you that you should not smoke, is that hard? No, because you are still a free person. You can say no quite easily. The same father says, whoever from the very first either regards the provocation dispassionately or drives it away by contradiction and gravity has cut off everything that follows in a single stroke because you stopped it at the provocation. So it is easy. If we learn to do battle from the moment of the provocation, notice something. There are listeners here of a young age and listeners of an advanced age. The younger listeners perhaps do not yet have as many passions as an older person may have. The older person, on the other hand, could have even more passions once he loads onto his back another 5, 10, 20 years. That is only natural. So at some point in our life, when something bad is just beginning to take root, we must always stay awake and stop it. You've seen people at 50 start to play cards or start, at that age, to drink wine. Notice, this happens at 50 years of age. You have seen people at 50 and at 60 begin to fall into bad company. For bad company is not a danger, only for the young. It is a danger for the old as well. When the Apostle Paul says, "Be not deceived, evil communications corrupt good manners," he is not saying this for the young. He is saying it for grown adults. And in fact, he is speaking of the matter of the resurrection of the dead, where the older ones are led astray by unbelieving people. And so the doctrine of the resurrection of the dead is undermined. I have even seen a man of 60 seduced by the bad company he keeps and abandon his wife. Yes, my dear ones. And go off to the courts to obtain a divorce at the age of 60 or 70. Yes, my dear ones. You know such stories, and I know them too. So that one can learn terrible things at any age at all. Therefore, at whatever point of our life we find ourselves, whatever passions we have acquired, strive to cut them off through struggle. And whatever new passion tries to begin in our life, we will say, stop, no further than this. The moment we realize that a new passion is about to assault us, we also need to make a distinction between a passion and a sin. It is in fact a serious distinction, because very often we muddle these things together and label them in the wrong way. What does passion mean? A passion is a sin that has become chronic. A sin in itself is not a passion. A sin is never a passion. When a person commits a single sin, or even several sins, indeed the same sin many times over, we cannot say that he has the passion of that sin. That is a mistake. He has simply fallen into that sin. Abba Dorotheos says, "The passions are one thing, and the sins are another. The passions are one thing. The sins are another thing altogether. The passions are these: anger, vainglory, hatred, and all such things." Sin, then, is the acting out of the passions when someone actively carries them out. Listen, pay attention, so you can see what a passion really is. I have the passion of hatred, but it lies there inside me. I carry the passion of hatred within me. And yet, at this very moment as I speak to you, I hate no one. Please pay attention. This point has great value, because it gives rise to a deception in our spiritual life. At this very moment, as I speak to you, I hate no one, and I get the impression that I am a very good person, because I love the whole world. But then the door opens, and a certain person walks in. The very one I had quarreled with, the one I hate. The instant I see that person, the hatred immediately flares up within my soul. So the passion is there, but it needs its object in order to flare up. And so I want to draw the conclusion that I am a very good person, simply because the object of the passion is absent. This is well known, or rather, what exactly is well known? Let me read it to you. This same father says it, St. Maximus the Confessor. "For when the sensible object is not present, the passions do not show themselves. Where there is no woman present, there is no fornication either. Take, for example, a man who has the passion of fornication, as long as the woman is not before him, when he is off in the mountains. Wherever the man may be, he does not have the object of his passion in front of him, and of course, the passion is not expressed. But this doesn't mean the passion isn't there. The passion exists, the sin does not. That is why he goes on to say that many passions lie hidden in our souls. The passions are concealed. Listen. They are brought to light only when circumstances bring them out. The passions come to the surface, precisely when the occasions for them are given. This is why the ascetics went out into the desert, not in order to escape the object of the passion, but in order to draw this passion out. This is a very important point. It is very important. Sometimes, before we come to find ourselves in the setting of a monastery, having left behind our home where perhaps we had our temptations, our familiar neighborhood, and so on, we say, ah, how lovely it is here, how wonderful.